Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELEC K25. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend talking about all the news in the world of sports. Jeff, we've got some great guests coming up. We've got Dick Vermeil, who's going to join us, talk some football. We've got Dan Schlossberg, who's going to join us, talk some baseball. I'm just excited you're well-rested for the show because the playoffs suck and you don't have to stay up to watch it.
Oh, shucks.
What's a sports fan have to do to get a good NBA or NHL final here? Come on.
Well, look, I don't even think we should go into the NHL finals. Usually they're great.
Yeah.
They're just not good this time. And by the way, I'm shocked.
Me too.
I really thought that this was going to be Edmonton's year. And who wants Florida to win?
Nobody. Not even the people in Florida.
Nobody.
Florida to win.
Right.
They throw rats on the ice, Jeff. I still don't understand that.
Well, that's fine. You don't know what the history of that is?
I get it.
All right. Well, I mean, it started with one of the hockey players years ago for killing a rat.
If we threw a cheesesteak on the field, it would be stupid. Anyway, that's not the issue today. The issue is...
Oh, so you don't like the octopus on the ice at Red Wings game?
No, I'm not. The only thing I like being thrown on the ice is hats.
To be fair, there's a whole species that doesn't like that either.
Yeah, the only thing
I'm sure the octopus don't like being thrown on the ice.
Hats on the ice for a hat trick and bears on the ice for when they do the charitable thing at the hockey games are the two things I like being thrown on the ice. That's about
really?
It.
Really? Yeah. See, I don't get the hats thrown on the ice. If I paid $30 for a hat, I'm not throwing it on the ice because somebody did something great. I'll just clap.
You're right. I don't throw my own hat.
Okay.
I just think it looks cool when other people do it. It's their problem that they've lost $30 for a hat, not mine.
You've lost your mind. Why would you? It's apparently a hat. Like, nobody goes to a game wearing a hat they don't like.
As I joke with my 7-year-old. That's a you problem, not a me problem. I just think it's a cool seat. And you got to be honest, the bears for the charitable give on the ice is the coolest thing, right? When they throw all the stuffed animals.
Yes, but that's planned.
Yes, exactly.
That's different than me taking off the hat that I wore to the game that I paid for, that I obviously like, and throwing it on the ice for it to be stuck in some case somewhere.
Okay, we'll leave the unplanned celebrations there. Was it planned that Luka would lose his mind in this series for the basketball?
Yes. Well, it wasn't planned. It was predictable. He's been a whiny player since he came into the league. He's probably been a whiny player since any of us knew who he was. He's immature. He's, quite frankly, as talented as he is, I would argue he's lazy. He's one of the worst defenders in the NBA. Period.
That's being on display.
He doesn't even try. I mean, I never even heard of the statistic that they keep throwing out during the finals about the number of times he does an ole. I forget what the statistic's called. But
did you see he apologized?
Like blow by or something like that.
Did you see he apologized to the team for his behavior after game 3? I mean, he's just like throwing tantrums looking for calls and then guys are running down the other end of the court scoring.
You have an entire team busting their butts for an entire game that is in a finals, which they don't know if they'll ever be back again. An apology doesn't do anything because an apology, if it was a one-time thing, is different. This is not. This is something that they apparently have talked about to him for years.
Yeah, apparently Dallas told him, do not complain. Do not do this. And he still...
And by the way, he plays a lot better when he doesn't.
Exactly. You know, it's funny, though. When they're winning, the trash talk is endearing. And when they're losing, he's a complainer.
No. But there's difference. Trash talk with other players is fine.
Yes.
Whining to the refs every single time you go up and down the court is not trash talk.
You become
it's
the
unprofessional, complaining, pointing the finger for something that you didn't do yourself. And by the way, the number of times that he has let players just blow by him, isn't it ironic that he decided that he was going to try to take a foul when he had 5?
Did you think it was a foul?
About it.
Do you think it was a foul? Or did you think it was?
Yes.
By the way,
a smart player doesn't put himself in that position.
Absolutely. That's the time that you ole it, when you have 5 fouls and you need to be in the game for everything else.
Yeah,
he's, the first quarter is not when you Olay it. You play the guy hard there, and if you pick up a foul, you adjust your game after.
He might want to consider becoming a bullfighter instead.
That would have been a good comeback if they would have come back there. Now they're down 3-0. Boston seems inevitable.
By the way, Joel Embiid finally said something I agree with.
I knew you. So I didn't understand how you found it because I knew he said it on Twitter and I didn't follow that. So somebody else must have sent it to you that you saw it and were made aware of it.
That's exactly what happened. How many times have I said to you on and off the air, I never understood why the Bucks got rid of Drew Holiday to bring in a one-dimensional player.
Neither does Jason Tatum. He was doing the post-game interview the other night. He goes, I don't know why, but thank you. Like, he is the reason they will win this title. Like, yes, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, but Drew Holiday brings the toughness to that team, without a doubt.
Do you think there's a lot of people in this city that even remember that Drew Holiday was the beginning of the process by trading him away so that they could get the rights to the draft pick that got them Nerlens Noel?
The processors remember it. I remember it very well. I literally watched the NBA looking at guys that played here that we didn't give a chance because we wanted to do some experiment and then needed to fill in pieces along the way for it. It's like, yep, we had him. We had Drew Holiday. We had Mikal Bridges. We had
Drew Holiday is a borderline Hall of Famer.
Yeah, and then he could have done that here.
He is the best two-way player in the league right now.
He could have done that here. Do you know who
And he's about to win his second title with two different teams.
I know you hate ratings. You know who the big loser is? ESPN getting two series that are so terrible.
Yeah.
Who's going to watch this? Nobody cares.
Yeah, this game four, if you're outside of Boston, is going to be rough.
I don't know if we're going to have time at the end of the show to talk baseball, but I did want to ask you, because we'll have to get to Dick Vermeil in a minute. Dan Hurley, staying at Connecticut, spurns the Lakers. Your thoughts on the process, how public it was, and are you surprised he stayed?
I'm not surprised he stayed. I'll end with that. But the amazing part of this is all of this came out at the beginning of the finals.
Yes.
It completely wiped out any discussion of the game that day.
Yes.
And then it turns out he didn't even come.
It's the most NBA thing to happen.
And the thing is Dan Hurley, if you're Dan Hurley, he has spent his entire life on the East Coast. He's a Jersey City guy. All of his jobs have been on the East Coast. I'm guessing he's not going to ever move west.
No, the Knicks are the team he goes to if he wants to coach in the NBA. Or Brooklyn.
Probably.
Or Brooklyn. Like he goes to an East Coast team.
I don't know why you'd go to Brooklyn. Brooklyn's a mess. That's the other thing about this is as hard as coaching in college has become. Yeah, but as hard as coaching in college has become, the fact is the NBA is a 3-year job for a lot of coaches. And so are you going to pick up your family and move them across the country for a 3-year job, especially the Lakers job? They can say all they want. They pitch this as a job where this is going to be a program. It's not. You have LeBron James and Anthony Davis there. And the idea is to win a title now. He has pressure to win this year with this roster.
He does. And now they can go back to JJ Redick, right? That's where this was going all along.
Yeah, but if you're JJ, do you want this job for the very reason that I said Hurley shouldn't want this job is that this is not a long-term job. This is a win-now job.
It depends how bad JJ wants to be a head coach, because this is the fast track to being it. But, I mean, he's the lead broadcaster, one of the lead broadcasters on the finals right now.
JJ is one of the people that we have met in this profession who can do anything he wants.
Yes.
He's the smartest guy in the room for real. And he is talented in so many different ways and smart in so many different ways. He interviewed for other jobs. He'll get another job next year if he wants. In the meantime, he'll make a boatload of money being an analyst, doing his podcast, and anything else he wants to do. He will be successful wherever he goes. If I were him, I wouldn't take this because he would think this is the last chance he's going
to
get.
It's funny, before we go to Dick Vermeil, I thought that the podcast with LeBron was his job interview. Let's leave it
there. It may turn out to be that way.
Let's leave it there and go to Coach. Let's welcome back to the show NFL Hall of Famer Dick Vermeil. Coach, always great to get a few minutes with you. Thanks for the time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you bringing me on so we can talk a little bit about the Concours d'Elegance, you know, at Simeo Museum coming up.
You know, Coach, not only do we want to talk about that and many of your other passions, because you seem to have so many of them, but before we get started on those, I personally just wanted to talk for a minute about wine, cars, and charity, especially since I had one of your Cabernets just a few weeks ago. How much are you loving working at the vineyard and producing the wines that you produce with your family?
You know, I'm just a small portion of it. I have partners that, with the financial side of it, that turned my hobby into a full-fledged business in 2008. And, you know, now it's a nice little business. It doesn't make money, but we pay all our expenses. But nobody's made any money. But we do make very good wines. And our wines are getting a very, very good grades, you know, 95s, 96s, 93s, especially the Cabernets. So we're proud of that. And we sell everything we make.
All right. Well, then here's the big question. Of those different wines, is your favorite the Super Bowl champion wine or your Hall of Fame wine?
No, my favorite is the Rosedale Block Cabernet. Oh, okay. The Rosedale Block of ground that the vines are that produce that Cabernet is the most respected piece of ground within the 170-acre vineyard by our winemakers. They claim if everything was perfect, they could produce a 100-rated Cabernet off that block of ground. And it's only about 2 football fields away from the Pickett Road Cabernet, which is not much below it, okay? So I'm proud of those, and I like them all. Though, if I was going to pick a favorite, I'd say the Rosedale Block Cabernet is my favorite.
Wow. All right. Well, that'll be next on my dinner list. The Pickett Road was the one that I had, which was amazing.
Yeah, it's expensive. All the wines are expensive. Now, you can spend more money and get not a better wine. You know, when you don't make very much, like, for example, we're talking about maybe 120 cases at the most of each one of those. So it's not a lot of wine. And, you know, we don't own anything other than really the label. So everything costs us a little more to make. You know, we don't own the vineyard, though my great-grandfather owned a good portion of it a long, long time ago. The same family that's owned it now over 100 years. Now the 4 kids run it. And I was babysitter for some of those kids. So I've been involved with the vineyard the whole time. The wines are made at Meadowood Winery in the Silverado Trail. Thomas Brown, our top wine consultant, owns part of it. So our wines are made there. And Timberonic is our main winemaker within that situation there. And they just do a very, very good job. Yeah.
You just have a passion for everything. You know, we knew your passion for football growing up as fans. We hear your passion for wine and your passion for helping people. Let's talk about Cool Cars for Kids and the Concours d'Elegance. You're a car guy. This year it is Jaguar for the show. But talk about who benefits and why it's so important that we support this effort.
Well, this effort supports genetic disorders. And, you know, CHOP, Children's Hospital, does a wonderful job with so many different things. But really, the genetic disorders, they have to raise some money on their own. It doesn't get supported quite like some of the major things that you hear about every day. But, you know, children are born every day with some kind of a genetic disorder. And we have a 32-year-old granddaughter, Amy Vermeil, that was born with a genetic disorder. And God love their parents, David and Janet Vermeil. They do a wonderful job with her. But these funds help support the things that the CHOP doesn't support independently, you know, like they do maybe the cancer funds and all the leukemia funds and all these heart funds and all these other funds. And I'm not being critical of them. It's just this makes this Cool Cars for Kids event each year more important. Okay. And Dr. Ian Krantz is the guy that heads it up. And he was the doctor that was involved with Amy Vermeil 32 years ago and since. And I just respect what he does and all the volunteers do to help raise money for this specific area of need. You know, and Simeon Foundation hosts the event. Now, you know, the gala is Saturday night, June 22nd, and it goes from 10 to 4. We serve good food, good wine, and get to tour the excuse me, get to tour the museum, which is one of the finest in the world. It might be the best kept secret in Philadelphia. I mean, it's a little hard to find, but it's unbelievable. And then next morning, starting at 10 o'clock, they have the concourse featuring the Jaguars, but there's far more than just Jags there. Believe me, the museum itself has one of the largest collections of the world of rare old car race cars, and with backed up by video scenes and showing the cars in action. And I get excited every time I go in there. Okay. I really do. It's such well done. Simeo Museum is not as 6825 Norwich Drive there over there in that airport area. Anyway, this is the 7th annual event. And thanks to Dr. Ian Krantz and all his, support staff. They're all volunteers. Okay. They're all volunteers, people that care about other people. And hopefully this will be our most successful. This is the first time we've held a gala, the dinner, on a Saturday night rather than a Friday night. And the museum Jaguar show on a Sunday rather than on a Saturday. I think last year we featured Porsches. Each year we feature a different old famous car, you know, and of course Jaguar is famous and still famous, you know, Porsche is famous and still famous, and Alfa Romeos, Bentleys, Mercedes, all these different cars. It's really a wonderful event.
You know, Coach, the amazing part of charity is not only the passion for the cause, but you've been able to merge that passion with your passion with cars. You've been on our show before talking about your background with cars and your family. Yeah. How important is it for you to be able to explore that passion and merge these two passions in order to raise money for such an important cause?
Well, you know, at 87 years old, you need to have things that continue to stimulate you mentally and emotionally. And these things, like the old cars, the wine business, giving people, it's a deep passion with me and my family and a lot of friends. And it's stimulating to get up every morning and still have something important to think about. I think it really helps me, on the emotional and mental side. You know, and it's just, I'm one of those kind of personalities. I need something to do today. Okay. And if I don't have it, I create it. And my wife, Carol, says, God, you get involved in so many different things. I said, you know, but it keeps me alive. It keeps me, affiliated with people that care about other people, you know, and every time I'm around those kinds of groups, and many of them, you walk away humble because you see so many people that give so much more.
Well, one of those friends you've come across through the years in the Eagles organization is Merrill Reese.
And oh, yeah. God bless him. Hall of Fame. Here he comes.
We saw the notification this week. He's going to be the 2024 Pete Rozelle Radio Television Award winner. Talk to us about Merrill and what it means for him to get that recognition. You're somebody who got that recognition recently yourself. Talk about that.
Well, you know, he earned the right to be selected for the Hall of Fame by being who he is. You know, he always was Merrill Reese. As a young man, I remember the first year when we lost our guy and he took over. I think it was 1977. And here's this young kid that had earned the right by doing the right things in preparation for the opportunity once he got it. And then every year he added to it. Then what, 12 years with Stan Walters? How many years now with Mike Quick? And to me, having worked in St. Louis for 3 and Kansas City for 5, there's nobody that matches him. Nobody matches him. And I'm so excited. I just found out myself, you know, I just found out that he's gone in. And Sal Palantonio texts me, and Sal Palantonio is another guy that deserves to get in there, and eventually he will. But I think every fan, football fan in Philadelphia will just relishes the thought that he's going into the Hall of Fame. Nobody deserves it anymore.
You know, Coach, somebody that's followed in your footsteps in coaching both the Eagles and the Chiefs, Andy Reid, another Super Bowl What do you observe about Andy Reid, the way that he does his job, and where he fits within the pantheon of coaches?
Well, to me, he's one of the two or three finest coaches that ever coached. Okay, you know, I'm on the Hall of Fame. Okay, and I feel guilty that there's other coaches that aren't in there yet, and hopefully they will. But as soon as Andy Reid becomes eligible, he will be in. There's nobody right now in the league doing a better job than he's doing. Nobody. And what I admire about him is his emotional stability. He's had many highs and lows on the field and in personal life, and he's been able to control all that and go from there and keep doing what he does better every year. It's just, I'm amazed by it. I'm amazed by it. You know, the other thing I'll tell you, the night of the Gold Jacket Award for me 2 years ago, I've come down out of the elevator. Now, Andy Reid's is in minicamp in Kansas City. I come down out of the elevator to go to the Gold Jacket Award the night before the induction ceremony. And who is standing there waiting for me? Andy Reid. Can you believe that? He's standing there, greeted me, congratulated me, hugged me, and it brought me to tears. And then he got back on a plane and flew back to Kansas City. How could he find time to show up there like that? It just shows you, I will never forget that. That's one of the finest honors of respect I've ever received in my life.
Well, I mean, you guys are a pretty small fraternity in terms of coaches that have gone through what you've all experienced. And you know, we've got our own here in Philadelphia with Nick Sirianni. Obviously, yeah. The end of last season was challenging. You're somebody who's gone through, you know, tough seasons, come back the next season, turnover with staff. Can you talk about the job that Nick has to do coming off of the hangover from last year with the new coordinators that are brought in?
Well, he's got to go back to the exact routine that he had when he took him to the Super Bowl, and then add to it. You know, you can't remain as good as you were in the NFL. You got to get better. That's why so many Super Bowl teams don't repeat the next year. They think they have arrived. You know, this is a new world. We're the best in the world, but you don't remain the best in the world by remaining doing the same things you were doing to get there. You got to keep improving. And I think Nick will accelerate the entire program, and I think they'll be a very, very fine football team. The new defensive coordinator is a fine, fine coach, and with many years of experience, and you've got to lean on those kind of people. When you lose good assistants, it's hard to replace them. And when you have great assistants, say, oh, get hired away, so you better be prepared. Yeah.
You know, Coach, that's one of the best sayings I've ever heard for sports in life. You can't remain as good as you were. And now you have the Eagles going into this season kind of saying the same thing by bringing in a running back at the level of Saquon Barkley. How important it is, even in a day where passing seems at a premium, to have a running game and to have somebody like Saquon Barkley in the backfield?
Yeah, well, he's the best of the best, okay? And I don't think he's lost a step. Yes, he went through injuries and that stuff, but he's never had a great support staff offensively. He's never had the offensive line he's going to have here. You know, Howie Roseman's done a spectacular job with personnel here. Yes, we all make mistakes from time to time. You're not going to be perfect. But his percentage of success with quality players is very, very high. And Saquon is going to be running behind an offensive line better than anything's run behind since he left Penn State, okay? And I really expect him to really excel. The big thing is give him a number of opportunities to show how good he is. If he only runs the ball 10, 12 times a game and catches three passes, you aren't getting your money's worth, believe me, because he is a guy that can break a game wide open, either catching the ball or running the ball. So I'm excited about his contribution.
Well, and obviously he'll have a new center blocking for him. And I'm curious, with the departure of Jason Kelce and Fletcher Cox, you saw a lot of leadership go out of the building. People had been here for a long time. You're somebody that had your seven principles of leadership. Can you talk as a coach about how you identify those core leaders on the team and how you develop your own principles?
Well, first off, you make sure how he drafts properly. and they fits the kind of character you want. So he doesn't come in with many character issues. Every once in a while, you know, there's a difference between guys that have serious issues and guys that are just immature. There's no correlation between age and maturity. Some kids have some issues because they're immature. And sometimes as a coach, especially if you've been in a long time, you could recognize all he needs is to get in a structured, disciplined program and buy and get him to buy in, and he'll excel. And Howie's done a great job with that. And Nick has done a great job. And the coaches before, you know, have done a good job. But you have to start with overall the evaluation of the people you bring into the program, that you draft, that you sign as free agents. Do they fit the mold that you want?
You know, Coach, you know, Jason mentioned it briefly with Jason Kelce. He was a leader on this team and a center. How important is it going to be for the Eagles, despite having the veteran offensive line that they have, to make sure that they find the next center? And how important, just in general, is a center to a team?
Well, to me, Kelce was more than a fine football player. He couldn't help himself to spread his passion for everything he does. That's his nature. He was gifted at birth. His parents passed on some great genes. Okay. His DNA is deep. And I think they'll be able to match his physical performance, but the combination performance will be very, very difficult to match. There aren't many of those guys around, you know. I'm sure he has some faults and weaknesses. His wife probably has found out over the years of marriage, but they're very few, and they aren't displayed on the football field, in the practice field, in the meeting room, or in the locker room. I've had players like that. Not many that reach his status.
You know, I wanted to ask you, there's nobody, no position in Philadelphia in any sport, I don't think, that takes quite as much scrutiny as starting quarterback in this city. Yeah. The favorite person is the backup quarterback, generally, until they are the starter in this city.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts about how Jalen Hurts looked at the end of last season? And, you know, obviously it's silly season, so everybody reacts at minicamp. What did he say? How did he look? What are your thoughts on Jalen Hurts, who says 95% of the offense seems new coming into this next season?
Well, I've said this before publicly. I don't think he has a limitation. I, as a fan outside, not being on the practice field or meeting rooms with him or on the sideline game day, I don't see any limitation. Last year, I think he did a real good job of controlling some uneasiness about everything going on within the scheme and within the play calling or within the game planning. It was just different from the person that was running it the year before. And boy, as an assistant coach, you need those quality guys. You know, as a head coach, you're supposed to be the best of the best. When you get guys jobs as coordinators, they better be the best of the best, or you don't look like best of the best. If I don't hire Mike March, Al Saunders, John Masco, and Dana LeDuc in 1999, to help me with my football team, we don't win a world championship. I don't win them on my brilliance, but I guarantee that. You need a complete organization to get to the top of that league. And he's restructured. He's probably given up a little bit of his control, but that'll give him time to be a better leader. You know, so I'm very optimistic, very optimistic.
You know, Coach, you were famous for your preparation. The Eagles are about to embark on something this season, which is a little unusual in having their first game in Brazil. If you were coaching now, how do you handle that? What do you do differently in order to prepare for the fact that you're traveling to another country and it's the beginning of the season?
Yeah, well, I'd handle it. If talk about handling it, I'd handle it poorly. My attitude wouldn't be real good about going over there. Okay. And I know that's part of the whole marketing scheme of the National Football League, and they aren't going to send losing teams over there. They're going to send teams with success that people are already aware of, regardless of where you travel. Okay. But I wouldn't like it. To me, if it doesn't help you, it hurts you. Okay. And I think that's a lot to ask. I mean, they will handle it well. They will handle it well, but I'm not excited about that approach. you know, we've handled the games in England and now Germany and now going to Brazil. We've handled them okay, and teams have come back. But I don't think I've ever talked to a coach who said they really enjoyed it.
No, I can't imagine. And I mean, they've got two new coordinators, a bunch of new players, and they got to start the season there. I did want to ask you, you talk about the importance of your own coordinators and Mike Martz, and you guys had the greatest show on turf. You know, Kellen Moore comes in here and, you know, how you talk about the job, how he's done. He's got all these weapons locked up, you know, through 2025, 2028. And all of a sudden you move from an offense that last year they had pre-snap motion on about 11% of the plays, a league low. His Chargers had 26%. What do you think we're going to see out of the offense that he implements with this team next year? We're going to see a little more creativity?
Well, I think the defenses that face him are going to have more issues to be confronted with. You know, you use motion to disguise and disrupt, okay, defensive schemes. And sometimes you'll use motion to dictate, because you'll go in a certain kind of motion and it will dictate a defensive response that you're expecting. And I think it helps open it up, really. I was coaching the league when people just started initiating any kind of motion. The guy that did it really the most, I think, was Tom Landry. But anyway, I think I like the new coordinator. I've watched him coach a lot at Dallas. I like the fact that he still uses the I formation. There isn't a running back in the NFL that runs better from a shotgun than he does the I formation, okay? There just isn't one. Yeah. Every record holder in the history of running backs right now, the top guys are all made a lot of yards running from the I formation without concern with how many people are in the box, okay? So I think he'll add that dimension. I think the play-action game will be better. I think they'll handle the blitz packages better. I think they'll handle certain things like that, because they have enough players there to make it work, So, and I think a change from time to time is good. It forces better focus every day. It's not old, the same old thing. Oh, we're running that again type attitude. Everything is new and stimulating. And sometimes it takes you a little while in the first part of the season to really get humming in it. I think it'll be really good for the offense.
Well, we could talk football with you all day, but we want to make sure we close. Most importantly, people should get their tickets now. It's the 7th annual Philadelphia Concours d'Elegance. The gala is Saturday night, June 22nd. The event is Sunday, June 23rd. Coach, thanks for all you do helping everybody in the community. That's more important than anything we ever talk football. So we appreciate you giving us the time.
Well, thank you. All that activity does more for me than I do for them, believe me. Wow. And I appreciate you bringing us on and talking about cool cars for kids.
Thanks, Coach. You have a great one.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
All right, Jeff, it's almost Father's Day this weekend. What goes better with Father's Day than baseball? So let's bring on journalist and author Dan Schlossberg, who has a book out that we can tell him about, too, that you can get for Father's Day. Dan, thanks for coming back on with us.
Great to be back on with you, Jason and Jeff.
You know, we enjoyed our conversation about your Hank Aaron book so much last time and have since gone on to talk additional Negro League conversation. I'm actually curious as we start, because the Negro League numbers being integrated happened after our interview. So I'm curious your thoughts on, given everything you talked about how much Hank Aaron struggled and didn't get recognition, what are your thoughts on baseball finally integrating the stats from the Negro Leagues?
That's a good choice of words, integrated. Very, very well put, actually. But my thoughts are that baseball made a mistake, a big mistake. And the reason is because you cannot take the stats from any leagues where the records were either lost or poorly covered. Newspapers that covered the Negro Leagues, like the Chicago Defender, went out of business. You know, the records of the Negro Leagues were just lost, basically. And it's hard to compare. Let's put it this way. Babe Ruth never faced a great black pitchers, and Jackie Robinson never faced a great white pitchers. So it's just, impossible to do it. However, if you look up the record, look up baseballreference.com, look up Josh Gibson's record. He never hit more than 20 home runs in a season, according to the integrated statistics. Well, that can't be. Thanks to Baseball Reference, they did a 162-game average that showed that he averaged 45 home runs a year. How could he average 45 home runs a year and never hit more than 20 in a season? As Yogi Berra would say, something's not kosher in the state of Denmark.
So talk to us about that. If integration is questionable in your mind with the numbers, is the recognition important of what these players did, given the recognition that Hank did not get while he was playing in the big leagues?
The recognition is critically important, and that's why we have the Baseball Hall of Fame. Many of the best stars of the Negro Leagues are in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But getting back to this issue of MLB using the records, SABR, Society for American Baseball Research, just came out with a report that said there were a whole bunch of leagues, black leagues, after 1948, which was MLB's deadline, that should have qualified as major leagues. In fact, all of Hank Aaron's home runs in the Negro Leagues, he had five, didn't count because they came out to 1948. Well, how do you draw this arbitrary timeline? I just think they made a mistake trying to do this. I know what they're trying to do, but you cannot research something that's not there. You cannot justify something that's not there. It was lost. It's a shame. It's too bad. But that's why we have the Hall of Fame.
Well, that does seem a shame. It's a shame that, see, I think that there is more value in integrating these numbers and including them than not. But I understand what you're saying, and it actually might be doing a disservice to some of the players in the Negro Leagues because the statistics were not kept as well. That their statistics are actually better than what is going to be recorded by integrating them because, as you say, the statistics weren't kept the way that they should have been.
Satchel Paige is a great case in point. He claimed that he pitched 2,500 games and 100 no-hitters. If you look up his integrated record, there's nothing that says that. So he obviously pitched more no-hitters than Nolan Ryan, but how many were in exhibition games or in pickup games? Sometimes these Negro League guys would play a triple header, maybe one scheduled game and two pickup games against a factory team. So that's just the way it was. They would do anything to make a living. And that's why they played all these exhibition games. But Satchel Paige, 100 no-hitters? I don't know. That's not what the record says.
Well, unfortunately, we can't ask Hank Aaron what he would have thought of what Major League Baseball did. You knew him well enough that maybe you can tell us what you think based on what you knew about Hank Aaron, how he would feel about this.
He was greatly discriminated against. In fact, it happened early and late in his career. Early in his career, when he was in the minor leagues, the Braves sent him down to Jacksonville in the South Atlantic League, also called the Sally League. It was an all-white league. He and Felix Mantilla and one other black player went down to integrate this league. They put up with a lot of abuse everywhere they went. In fact, I once asked Hank, I said, was there any city that you enjoyed going to, or were they all bad? He said they were all bad. Every city in the league, including his home Jacksonville City. So that was just the way it was, unfortunately, in 1953. But he spoke with his bat. He was the MVP in that league, most valuable player in that league. The next year, he was in the major leagues. So Hank Aaron went through a lot. And then later in his career, as he approached Babe Ruth's record, there are a lot of bigots out there who didn't want to see a black man go after a white man's hallowed record. And they threatened his family. They threatened Aaron's life. That's why his kids were not present when he hit number 715. You see his wife there. You see his parents there. His kids were with their biological mother in Jacksonville watching on television because of the threats against Aaron's life. In fact, Aaron told Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr, two young black outfielders on the Braves at that time, not to sit next to him on the bench in case somebody shoots him during the game.
It's that story.
This is what we had to live with.
It's that story, which we talked about last time, that has stuck with me watching baseball now and watching how close all the players are in the dugout and the celebrations they have and just how he had the opposite. He encouraged people to stay away from him for their own safety, let alone his. I just can't imagine what it was like to go to work every day telling people, don't come near me for you.
And on the road, He had to stay in separate accommodations from the team, had to eat in separate restaurants. Some nights he just slept at the Braves ballpark when they were home. And the reason was he got all this hate mail. In 1973 alone, he got 930,000 pieces of mail. Not all of it was hate mail by any means, but a lot of it was. Dusty Baker said he would just throw it on the floor in the clubhouse so the other black players could pick it up and read it. This is what Hank Aaron was up against. Babe Ruth never had something like that when he was going for 714.
So we don't have that today facing baseball near as much, but we do have other threats to players and other problems that baseball's facing. And I had sent Jeff a story earlier about baseball players that are being threatened over gambling now. And you're somebody who has watched this game. You are a historian. You've covered it for decades now. We saw five players suspended last week for gambling. I mean, they basically threw away their career over losing a couple $100s. Can you talk about the impact that you're seeing as somebody who's watched this game that gambling is having on it now? We had the Pete Rose time. We've had other players. You don't gamble on games. But now they tell you don't gamble on games while it's sponsored by FanDuel or ESPN Bet. So can you talk about gambling in baseball?
Jason, I'm glad you brought that question up because very few people have talked about it. Years ago, Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle were greeters at an Atlantic City casino. They were suspended from baseball by Bowie Kuhn because of their association with gambling. That was tame compared to what's going on today, where you read on all the websites what the odds are, what FanDuel says, there's so many different ones. And if baseball is in bed with gambling, which it is to raise more revenue to cover payroll, how do you discipline the players not to bet on baseball? They are allowed to bet on other sports. The first thing you see in the clubhouse, when you walk in the clubhouse, the first thing you see is a sign that says gambling on baseball is not permitted. Actually, what that means is gambling on your own team is not permitted. And what did Pete Rose do? He was a manager of the Cincinnati Reds. His team, during his five-year tenure, finished second every time. It probably should have finished first once or twice. I'm willing to bet, and I don't know this for a fact, I'm willing to bet he bet against his own team, knowing he can make the Reds lose. A manager can't make a team win, but he can make a team lose. And if money is that dear to him and that important to him, why would he not do that? And he never really admitted exactly what he did. He never really apologized for what he did. Had he done that, he would have been in the Baseball Hall of Fame years ago.
Well, not only that, he wrote, I believe, two books, one saying he didn't and one saying he did. So he finds ways to capitalize no matter what the truth is.
He wanted to sell more books.
Yeah. And to your point, just so people understand, you don't have to bet against your team for it to be bad. Like there are people that say, well, as long as you bet on your own team, what's the big deal? Well, no, if you only bet on certain game to win, but then don't bet on other game, it could have the same impact because people then know, wait a second. Why is the manager or the player betting on their team to win only sometimes, but not other times? So when people say that, it always baffles me because there are ways that you can gamble without necessarily showing your hand. And to me, the concern is with baseball, as Jason started talking about, is you've now opened this can of worms. All sports have now opened this can of worms. I don't think anybody actually anticipated some of the things that are now coming out, which isn't just that the players are gambling, but players and coaches and members of teams are being harassed and threatened because their statistic, they're not getting a hit here or there. They're not doing this because these people are gambling. Is there a way to stop it?
I would hope so. Personally speaking, I mean, I watch MLB Network a lot. What I resent probably the most about MLB Network is watching all the odds that are posted for every single game. I'm not a gambler. I don't care about the odds. I care about the winning and losing pitcher, who hit home runs, what the standings are, who's going for MVP, Rookie of the Year, Cy Young Award. That I care about. The gambling, I could care less about it. If MLB Network would get rid of it, that would be great. However, FanDuel and others are sponsors of MLB Network. They can't get rid of it. They're in bed with gambling. It's too bad.
Well, they've got two problems there in terms of their network and their television stuff. They're funded more by gambling in terms of the advertising side of the revenue. And then on their distribution side of the revenue, revenue, they've got a lot of these networks that are in bankruptcy. So they've got markets where they can't even see the games because either the local service is in bankruptcy or they're fighting with a cable company. So baseball's got a squeeze going on from both sides. They can talk about the product on the field, and we can get to the changes and the rules and stuff. But off the field, they're trying to grow their base. Jeff and I talk about this all the time because I gambled in a prior life and quit. Jeff does not like gambling. And so I have a little more of a palate for it in what I'm watching. He has none. But I think that these leagues, rather than pushing the personalities of the players that they have, they're pushing to get them hooked on the excitement of having some money on the game. And so then you get into, they have to watch it on TV because they've got money on the game, as opposed to they can just follow their player. So I think you kind of have like one or the other kind of coming first year that are converging a little bit.
Now, one thing we should mention is Shohei Ohtani. This is a bigger deal than baseball is letting on. He is the golden child of Major League Baseball. Nothing can harm him, according to commissioner's office. However, this gambling scandal, how can anybody borrow or steal even $16 million from a close friend the way his interpreter is charged with doing? Something is not right with that. My gut tells me, and I can't substantiate this, what if Shohei paid off his interpreter to take the fall?
Well, Jeff kept asking that on the show. How did the accountant not know? How did the lawyers not know? Like, separate from, like, it's one thing to say you logged into your friend's account and stole his information. It's another thing to have all the professionals that he pays for all the money that he makes not realize that there's money being siphoned out and missing.
Yeah, very true. And by the way, when I talk about Hank Aaron, I always say he's first in clean home runs, meaning no cheating, no steroids, right. Also no gambling. He was one of the most honest, had more integrity, just an incredible player, humble man, an introverted man. There's no way that he would have put up with gambling. If he had seen that in the Braves clubhouse, it would have been exposed instantly.
So, yeah, I just want to talk about Shohei Ohtani for another minute. It is in just the larger context. Well, first of all, in the smaller context, it makes no sense. Some of the things that have come out, there are governors in place when large sums of money are to be taken out of an account. Having your interpreter call and say, hey, by the way, wires a couple million dollars here or there is not something that normally happens. The fact that this went away so quickly because the interpreter is going to jail, does that mean now that this investigation is actually closed, or does it mean that the investigation is still going on under the current to make sure that nothing comes out later on? Because to me, the worst thing that baseball or anybody can ever do is cover something up. The best thing to do is just come forward and come clean. If they sweep this under the rug and somebody like you then uncovers it and writes a story on it, it is a much worse situation, especially when it's a gambling issue in baseball.
I totally agree. MLB, when they suspended these five other guys, including one guy for life, they announced that Shohei is cleared and that investigation is closed. Maybe that's what the commissioner's office says, but the feds have not said that. I believe their investigation is ongoing. We'll see. We have not heard the end of this. It's too big of a deal. $16 million? That's too big of a deal.
Well, and it's larger than just Shohei and his friend. It's the bookie. And the bookie is what has been the catalyst to take him and other people down. So it's a question of who else tells tales about who else is involved around this. You had, I think it was another one of Shohei's teammates who got suspended for gambling as well.
David Fletcher was in AAA.
Yeah, so I did want to ask, you know, you're somebody who watches a lot of baseball. Jeff and I have debated rules forever. He loved when they did the shift. I hate the ghost runner.
No, I didn't love the shift.
No, getting rid of it. Getting rid of the
difference.
Yeah, sorry. I should clarify. He loved banning the shift. He has complained about the shift for years. I hate the ghost runner.
I agree with both of you. You're both right.
We both kind of enjoy
that. Never happens, by the way. We're not both right.
Yeah, that, normally one of us is definitely wrong. Oftentimes me. Where are you on the new rules? We kind of like the shorter game. Might be a little bit faster than some people would prefer. But how do you feel about the changes that baseball has made so far?
Some are good and some are awful. Let's talk about what I call the Manfred Mann being the automatic runner.
I hate it.
You know who Manfred Mann is, right? Yeah. I'm sure you do.
Yeah. Blinded by the light.
There you go. This is the most idiotic, disgraceful, embarrassing, abominable rule in baseball history, without question. Rob Manfred should be shown the door right now. And if it's such a great rule, Rob, how come you don't use it in the postseason? Because it sucks.
By the way, Jason, that's what it looks like not to sit on the fence.
That may be the best quote we've gotten on the show in all of our years doing. And you're right. I mean, it just drives me absolutely crazy. All of a sudden, like, you could have nothing going on in the base path all game. And you get to the ninth inning, and it's like, okay, if you don't do it here in the 10th inning, you're going to have base runner out there. Good luck. And it's like, just move him over, get him in. That's what drives me nuts, though. It's so arbitrary. Like, hey, let's try to make the game faster by throwing a runner out there. Like, if you want to speed up the game and have a pitch clock and things like that, you're working within the pace of play of the game. It just seems so random that they decided that that was something that would be a good rule.
And it's about to get worse.
Why?
Because do you know how they're going to... If the All-Star game happens to go into extra innings, they're not using the Ghost Runner. They're going to have a home run derby to decide the All-Star game.
Yeah, but that's the All-Star game. I mean, look, at this point...
It should have integrity. The All-Star game needs integrity.
I am on your side. This is Jason will call this a get-off-my-lawn issue. But the fact is, the All-Star game is an exhibition. So, yes, it would be great if
Jeff
we could all go back to our child. No, it would be great if we could all go back to our childhood and have the All-Star game where it mattered. Where people busted their butts and it meant something to win it just out of pride, then that would be great. We're not going back to that for the All-Star game. We should, but we're not.
The All-Star game has so many things wrong with it. I don't even know where to begin. Number one, it should be a day game on the weekend, as it is in every other sport.
Thank you.
Well Jason agrees with that.
A night game on Tuesday night?
Thank you.
How on the East Coast, they watch half the game, they have to go to bed.
How are you going to grow your audience?
Some of us go to bed before it starts.
How are you going to grow your audience?
Besides that, the fans are too stupid to vote. They're too stupid to vote. When I was a kid and I grew up, the players, coaches, and managers voted. It was one man, one vote. You could not vote for teammates. That was an objective, fair election. This one is like an election in Honduras. You can vote five times in one day, every day. It's absurd.
That I don't understand. Why do you get to vote multiple times?
Look,
nobody's ever explained to me what exactly the logic is behind that.
In fairness,
you spend more time on your computer involved in baseball. That's the logic.
Yeah, they want you to engage more. But in fairness, I used to get a card at the ballpark and I would check off Rico Bronya and every other Philly that didn't deserve to be on the All-Star team because they were a Philly and I thought it would be there. So I don't know that it was ever a perfect process, but Adam Silver was talking...
Never.
Wait, hold on. We need to stop this right now because, Jason, the fact that you voted for Rico Bronya for the All-Star game is making Dan's points about fans being too stupid to vote.
But I should not have been able to vote, but I was. And so I would just vote for every Philly. Not that they deserve to be there, but they were my guys. And that's what I think a lot of people do.
Every team is promoting vote for your favorites for the All-Star game.
Yes.
Well, I'm a Braves fan. I just got an email yesterday. It said, send these guys to Texas. And it showed to the 8 Brave starters. And you know, I put a little comment on that. You know what I said? Send these guys to Gwinnett.
Well, I mean, and look, I can. So,
for
okay.
People that don't know, that's their AAA team.
So you're a Braves fan.
They belong the way they're playing.
You're a Braves fan. And I mean, for the Phillies here, the last 2 years, Phillies have been 10 plus games back at this time. It's a reversal this year in terms of the injuries the Braves had and how they have played recently. What is going on with that franchise? Is that a larger problem than the injuries, or is it just the injury bug with them?
One of my issues in baseball in general is long-term contracts. Everybody used to have a one-year contract. That was a much better way to do it. And on top of that, nobody knew what the other guy was making. If you work in a factory, do you want to know what the guy down the hall is making? And then you can go to the boss and say, well, he's making so much, I'm worth more. That's ridiculous. And that's what baseball has done by exposing everybody's salary. It's made it horrible for everybody in baseball.
I feel like I've found Jeff's spirit animal to do this radio show with here. I mean,
yes. Dan, what are you doing on Fridays? Jason may have to go.
This is literally like I'm the he says I'm the younger one, but not by that much. But I have a shorter attention span and came up with a little bit more technology. So he's a little bit more of like, let's leave this the way it is. But I just listening to you, it's so funny because that literally is Jeff's perspective regularly. Why do we have to change this? It's not broken. What's wrong with this?
Well, look, getting back to the All-Star game for a second, I have so many bones to pick with this thing. Reggie Jackson was once elected a starter with a batting average of 199, but that wasn't the worst offense. Davey Lopes was once elected with a batting average of 169. 169, and the Dodger fans stuffed the ballot box and picked him. How about, Mike Schmidt. He was elected a starter after he retired. I can go on and on.
Sympathy pick.
And wait, what's wrong with that?
You should not vote for your favorite players ever. You should vote for the most deserving players. Every team that promotes vote for your favorite is wrong, and it should not be allowed. And if we had a commissioner with a spine, it would not be allowed.
So I won't.
By the way, so that reminds me, the Mike Schmidt thing is awesome. Not because it should happen, but it then reminds me of something that never happens now, which is Old Timers Day.
Right.
As a kid, that was just like, I don't know what made me think of it. It's completely off topic, but I miss Old Timers Day.
I do too. Well, the Braves have an Old Timers Day because they have the two oldest pitchers in the National League and Charlie Morton. And Jesse Savage.
Every day is Old Timers Day. Look, before we let you go, I got to ask you, you're talking about your pitching staff. Philly's pitching staff is doing something that baseball is not doing these days in terms of the amount of innings they're going and how they're pitching. Surprising you what the Phillies are able to do with their pitching staff right now this season?
Not really. The Phillies have really repaired what was a terrible bullpen. They've really fixed it. It's doing much better. The Phillies and Braves both are likely to have three starting pitchers each going to the All-Star game. And that's kind of remarkable. Few teams can do that.
Well, look, Dan.
And to be an old-timer again, they're doing it by pitching more than six innings. I mean, the Phillies have almost not old-time pitching staff, but older-time pitching staff than the modern pitching staff.
Yeah, Dan, we talked to Jamie Moyer about that a few weeks ago, about the change in pitching and max effort as opposed to, you know, looking to go deep in games and pitch innings and just the change in that. Look, we could talk baseball all day with you. We got a run today, but we'd love to have you back another time. If people are looking for something to do for Father's Day, pick up the book, Home Run King, The Remarkable Records of Hank Aaron. You will not be disappointed. Dan, thanks so much for giving some time to us.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Jeff. And tell Jamie Moore that Braves need a fifth starter.
He could probably still get out there and sling it.
He wants 300.
There you go. Take it easy, Dad.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, man.
Dan, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Seriously, you're like...
That was great. I had a great time, too. You're barking.
Oh, no worries.
I didn't even hear the dog barking.
You're like...
The dog is barking at the landscaper.
All right, Jeff. We got about 30 seconds left. It is Father's Day weekend. Say something profound.
I have got nothing profound, but I will say to you, who is a two-time dad, happy Father's Day. And to every dad out there, this is the weekend. If you can get to a ball game, just go do it.
Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.